statistician with Janssen R&D, and I support large molecule discovery in the immuno-oncology space. We've all heard the saying that a picture's worth a thousand words, and I have a case study here that's going to suggest that a StratiMap is worth magnitudes more. Now, I said I work with large molecules, and what I'm talking about specifically is antibodies. Now, I have to do the international gesture for antibody, where we have a stem and we have two active sites. So, the scientists I was working with wanted to compare two monoclonal antibodies and a bispecific antibody. The monoclonal antibodies have the same active site on the tips of the Y, whereas a bispecific antibody is combined so that one of the active sites comes from one parent antibody and the other active site comes from a second parent antibody. The natural comparison that you want to make at that point is which one works better. It doesn't look like this is
exactly. That's very long.
Yeah. So the statistical part behind doing this comparison is pretty easy. You find a maximal comparison between your matrix of bispecific doses, you compare it to a bispecific antibody, and you can do Wilcoxon, it's not hardly involved. But what we did find was that the data was not particularly well characterized, and looking at it graphically was one of our big challenges.
Okay.
This is a simple way to look at it graphically. So this is two-dimensional box plots, and it's dose response condition of antibody A conditional on each individual dose of antibody B. And if your data looks like the left-hand plot, which is fake data, then this is great. You can actually picture the three-dimensional shape in your mind. My data was on the right. That is not clearly imaginable. So you can show it as a three-dimensional scatter plot instead. And this is nice because you can also have good quadratic surface, and I can compare a plane with my bispecific response in addition. So the code for this comes from the CAR library, from the CAR package, and you can look up the code yourself, but the point I want to make is about the view 3D. Now this is still, even though it's a three-dimensional scatter plot, it's in two dimensions. You've got to pick a place to look at it from. I look at it from what looks nice to me. I'm sure the scientists want to look at it from a way that is biologically important. So rather than have us work out which way to look at it, I saved it as a movie file. Now this is great. They think this is great. We put it on their desktops. And you can look at it from any point. You can stop it. You can rewind it. And you do this through the RGL package. Okay. So you need two things. You need the RGL package, and you need to install ImageMagick, which is an open source video compiler that takes all the individual JPEGs and puts them together into a .mob file, an MPEG, a GIF, or if you don't like a GIF, you can say it as a GIF, whichever. And it's great. If you've got one experiment, one outcome. I didn't. I had two experiments, high dose and low dose for antibody A. I had six outcomes, that's six immune molecules, four cytokines, two T-cell proliferations, and then I had two human serodonors. So I need to look at it overall and by human serodonor, because humans respond differently immunologically. So if you're playing along at home, that's 2 × 6 × 2, 24 movie files. What can we do to make this easier? Almost 20 seconds. We can do this in a Shiny app. All right. I put the slide in so I can actually take a breath. I know I'm preaching to the choir, and the Shiny app just makes it so easy. You've got all of your different places where you can click. You can flip between whatever your permutations are. So this is a movie of my Shiny app. Those are my options on the left-hand side. This is a really easy app. You can spin it around. You can zoom in. You can zoom out. You can flip between the different options. And what's really nice, and I don't have saved in this movie, you can right-click, whenever you have it oriented the way you want, you can right-click and save image as. So I don't have to have any hand in view 3D. That's something that the scientists can do all on their own. It's really convenient for them. And it makes it much easier to explain things like sample points, which are hard to do. I'm not going to show the R code for this, but I am going to say you need Shiny RGL, and when I was working with it, it took a little bit of coaxing. Shiny RGL, RGL played together, and then RGL was updated and it didn't. I had a fix, and then I updated my R version, and they didn't. RGL widget fixes it all now. So so it works great. In conclusion, sometimes showing things in 3D is a bit of a challenge. So use a Shiny app, makes your life a lot easier. Thank you very much.
Verify that 20 seconds is 24 seconds. Okay, so the next speaker is this person. You're here?
Yeah.
Right, so I'm going to set it up now, so for now on it'll be 20 seconds.
Okay, thank
you. So it'll advance. So you can take this time and steal it to introduce yourself.
So my name is I currently work as a data scientist at Maple Storage, but I will present our package, which is done and published in 2014, together with my dissertation and the paper. And, it's called TBuzz, in short for Tree Branches Evaluate Statistically for Chinese. You can just search TBuzz from Korean, and here's my email for, because I'm the maintainer, so you can always contact me for this package. So basically, we need a clustering tree as a foundation. So TBuzz is used to identify distinct tree branches in hierarchical clusters. And so for example, you want to, so it's unsupervised learning, and you want to use hierarchical clustering. And further, you want to know what is the statistical significance of each cluster, and you want to use this method. Just use a figure to further explain. So panel A here is one-dimensional Gaussian mixture. I use three normal distributions in blue, green, and black. So you can see that blue and green clusters are rather tight. So we use this annotation at H as a height. It's actually a similarity measure. And you can see the corresponding clustering tree here. So there are these three nodes, and we use this branch height, where it is dissimilarity measurement, to define a statistic. Then we perform permutation tasks to decide the statistical significance of each cluster. And here's a paper you can refer to for this for details of this methodology. Then I'll explain. There are some benchmark cases you can always look for in this paper. So, for example, this is done by looking at leukemia samples. We know the branches that there are three different types here. So, if you look at just the graph A and D, so it's hierarchical clustering. We have the tree structures, and we want to know if TBuzz can find these three exactly the same clusters. So based on this tree structure, you can see we find a statistical significance 0.001. And comparing with other three approaches, our method is better to find this. So here's the demo. You can download this from Korean and load it the package, and you can always, so the best example would be use a question mark the plot function, then you can have a thorough example from processing the data and then plot the tree. So main functions are sig trees, and sig tree is computing the significance of each branch, and we use partition tree to look at if there is a partition of tight clusters, and then we plot the tree with some annotation of the p-values, and the leaf content, we use it to look at, like, in each cluster, what are the labels, the names of each sample. So for example, running this code will give you this plot, and you can see these three clusters with this red color p-value. So these correspond exactly to the benchmark analysis I just showed you, these three exact same clusters. And here you can see I also named the distance and cluster here. This is by using plot the partition. So you can see this full partition of the tree, but you can also use just plot the significance for each cluster. So takeaway here, when to use TBuzz, so when you don't have prior knowledge of number of clusters and you want to investigate the hierarchical structure of the tree. So what it gives you, will give you the significance of each the tree. So I want to send my professor Alexander Kostnets in this NCI program to sponsor my PhD research, Cold Spring Harbor Lab, Stony Brook University. And I'm currently a data scientist at Nimble Storage, but you can always come to me because I'm the maintainer of this package. So if you have any questions interested in this package, please come to me. That's the supplementary material. So okay, so I also use this data, well-known data, to use the method TBEST. So for example, here you can see by clustering, you can see only like two clusters from these three species. And this will show you the p-value. So it's not like 0 or 100 because I run it to integer and the multiplied by 100. But you can see that this species is very tight together. So and that's exactly the same with the scatter plot.
And today, hopefully, if my slides come up, then I'm going to talk a little bit about the forecasting techniques that we've been developing. And I won't have much time to talk about the actual results of applying said techniques because I want you to take away the idea behind the forecasting methods that we employ. And generally, forecasting is pretty difficult, particularly when you try to predict the future, but almost everyone has to do it at some point in their life. And in practical applications, people frequently need to forecast many time series at different horizons. Frequently, you have data that can be helpful to forecast, and you want to be able to use some state-of-the-art method to forecast things. And generally, there's two best methodologies to do forecasting, which is based on time series methods and based on a regression method. And time series methods are awesome to do trend and seasonal decompositions. And regression methods are good when you have a lot of externally available data. But what would be really good if we could combine the two, and this is what we propose in this approach. We take forecasts from time series methods, and we use them as features in a regression-based framework. And from there on, we can... I'm going to illustrate this with a little bit of math and diagrams. So let's imagine why is the series I want to forecast. We're going to take a short window of this series, and on that window, I'm going to train a univariate time series model. You can think of a RIM model, exponential smoothing, anything that you can use for a univariate time series can be employed. When we train this model, we do predictions several steps ahead. So F is going to be the prediction. F7 conditional on 6 means I predict for period 7 at time equals 6, and if 8 conditional 6 means prediction for period 8 at time 6. It's one step ahead, two step ahead forecast. And you can do it many steps ahead if you need to. Then you move the window one period, and you repeat the entire procedure. You take a new model, apply it to this window, and you get forecast out of that model. And I really wish this would be like a little faster, but I don't make the rules. So from the second model, we're going to have forecasts for period 8, period 9, and potentially more. And if you were paying attention carefully at this point, we're going to have two forecasts for period 8. There's going to be a two-step ahead forecast from previous slide and the one-step ahead forecast from this slide. So this procedure will then be repeated until we run out of y's, and then we're going to combine them in a data frame like this, where y's are going to be the target variable, and F is going to be the features. And you can have many F's for different time series methods as columns. So now you've brought the time series predictions into a regression domain. And from here on, we can include whatever other features you can possibly envision. And I'm going to briefly list what are the things that we've incorporated in the package and what we've found use from. So the first thing, obviously, as will hopefully come up in a second, is date-based features. So there's a lot of information you can extract from a time series purely from the temporal component of it, like what's the year, what's the quarter. If it's high-frequency data, you can have dates, and if it's retail application, then the holiday dates are usually very predictive for sales, all that kind of stuff. If you've ever worked with these data, you know what I'm talking about. then you can have a bunch of information from the historic values of wine rather than the temporal component. We have to fix a little bit of a problem that we found in ours, that if you have dirty time series data, like data for quarter one and quarter three, but not quarter two, most lag functions in ours don't do lagging correctly, so we have to fill in these problems. And then, of course, what the big sell is that we can include information that is completely not contained in the series you want to forecast. There's a few data sources that we've combined, and the one that tends to come up a lot in many applications is promotions and other external business drivers. In terms of implementation, we have this package that we call Baseline Forecast, which is, we use this tool as a baseline for many forecasting applications we have. And there's basically only two functions to be aware of. One is the construct data set that takes a series and gives you all the features. And fit model uses Max's carry package to train learners such as XGBoost or whatever else you can think of, and does time series cross validation. So there's still a bunch of work left here, and the worst part about it is that so far this is not available for anyone to use because it's on my private GitHub repository. And if there's a lot of demand for it, let me know.
My name is Jeffrey Gonzalez, and I'm from the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. I'm a mathematical research statistician there. I'll be presenting a package that my colleague Karen Savitsky developed. So any questions regarding this package should be directed at him and not me, so let's hope I can do this presentation justice. So this package will be used for the clustering of hierarchically linked data sets. So just a brief overview of Grow Clusters, which is the name of the package. It basically implements a maximum a posteriori estimation of partitions derived from a multivariate Gaussian mixture of the mean, either under a Dirichlet process mixing measure or a hierarchical Dirichlet process mixing measure. The two key features of Grow Clusters are that it has two penalty parameters, one associated with a global clustering penalty and a second associated with a local clustering penalty. And together, these determine the number of local and global clusters. There's also a correction for an informative sampling design. And if any of you have worked with survey data, you know that it's typically acquired under an informative sampling design, which basically means that the probability of inclusion into the sample depends on the survey response, such that the distribution of the observed sample is different from that of the population. As a motivating example, we use this for outlier detection under an informative sampling design, apply it to the concurrent employment statistics program. And the big picture is that there are quality checks needed to detect submission errors, particularly among those influential establishments. The CES uses a stratified sampling design, the strata constructed by state industry class and employment size, and the inclusion probabilities are set proportional to the average employment size. And because the way the inclusion probabilities are formed, it induces a correlation between the employment levels and the inclusion probabilities. So the primary functions of Grow Clusters involve a DP cluster function as well as an HDP cluster function. And this HDP cluster is the sort of innovative one, as it estimates a local partition for each element of a list input, where the jth element contains a data matrix, and then each local partition draws its cluster means from a single global partition. There are also two functions, numclusters DP and numclusters HDP, which estimate a local and or global parameter, penalty parameters for input in either the DP cluster or the HDP cluster function. There's also an S3 function called plot that inputs a return object from DP cluster or HDP cluster and provides two types of plots, an assignment of units to clusters, as well as an estimated cluster location means heat map. So just to illustrate the package and these the plots, we have an implementation of HDP cluster. The population, there's a typo on here, it should be 6 global clusters and 4 local clusters, and we draw an informative sample using probability proportional to size within each data So the first set of plots I'd like to talk about are plots focused on the assignment of units to clusters, and these are basically histograms of assignment counts of each local partition to the associated global clusters linked to all of the local partitions. So as we can see, this algorithm, it's a small sample, as we can see, this algorithm correctly identified that there were four local clusters drawn from six global clusters. So on the y-axis, we have the number of observations within each local cluster, and on the x-axis, we have the global cluster identification. And this is faceted by each data set that you input into the function. The second set of plots are focused on the estimated cluster means, which basically produces heat maps of randomly selected observations within each data set and within each estimated local cluster linked to a global cluster. And so we have a faceted plot of one for each data set. On the y-axis of each plot, we have just randomly sampled observations. Remember, it's a small sample size, so that's why it might look a little funky. And then our data set actually has 15 dimensions, or 15 x covariates. And so we can see a heat map for each of the local clusters within a data set and the values associated with each of those observations from the randomly plotted, or randomly selected observations, which are plotted in the heat map. That should be loud. Okay, can I have 4 extra seconds?
Okay, so I'm Carlos, I'm from the Central Bank of Brazil. You're seeing like a wide range of applications here from VAR. And I'm going to present an R package that I'm developing with Thiago, who also works at the Central Bank of Brazil. And the usual disclaimer applies here, this is our own work, it does not necessarily reflect the views of our employers. So this project here, we created this package to implement some tools to analyze systemic risk in financial networks. And we have currently implemented matrix reconstruction methods, a unified and flexible contagion framework, and other risk measures based on the communicability matrix of the financial system. So to give you an idea of the gist of the problem that you're asking, let's imagine this sample network is a financial network, so the nodes would be banks and the edges would be debt. So this would represent like how much a node impacts the other node. And we're trying to see who are the systemic nodes, who are the important or the central nodes of this network. And we could use like traditional centrality measures to answer that. For example, node H would be the most important one if you use out strength or closeness or page rank. And node A would be the most important one if you use betweenness. And you can use iGraph or other packages to compute that in R. But the, some of these metrics might not have an economically meaningful interpretation for systemic risk. So another approach could be to answer the following question. How would the nodes default impact the system? And here I will show you only two popular short propagation methods. It's traditional default cascades and the debt rank. So what I want to show here is what happens if we default node B using traditional default cascades. The traditional default cascade uses a threshold propagation method. So the node only propagates a shock if it completely defaults. And if you recall, node B was not an important or the most important node in any of the metrics. But if you use the threshold default cascade in this network, node B collapses the whole system when it defaults. And to run that simulation with our package, you just use the contagion function and you pass method equals threshold. Okay, you can get some summary statistics for the simulations, like additional defaults, additional losses, and additional stress. And what I want to point out here now is for you to pay attention on node E. Using the traditional default cascade, node E is not that systemic. But what could happen if I change the propagation method? So now I want to show you what happens if we default node E using a depth rank propagation. The depth rank propagation is a linear propagation method. So a node, if it loses X percent of its reserves, it's gonna propagate X percent losses to its creditors. And in this case here, Node E, which was not that systemic, now it almost completely defaults the system. To run that simulation, you can use the same code as before, you just change the method to depth rank instead of threshold. And we have other methods too, but we're not gonna show here due to the time. And like before, you can get the summary statistics of the simulations just using the summary method provided by the package. And now you can see that node E that was not that systemic, now it's the third most systemic node of the network. Oops.
Solve and set the timer to infinity.
Is it still going on?
I say.
Okay, so
good job. You got it.
All right.
Well, knowing 26.
Okay, so yeah, so Node E now, you can see that Node E using the threshold propagation was not that systemic, and with the linear propagation, it's. Now, another problem you have, you might not have the data on lateral exposures. So, but you might have some partial data on that. For example, the total assets, the row sums, or the total liabilities, which would be the call sums. And for that cases, we are implementing some matrix estimation methods. And we have implemented two methods, the maximum entropy estimation. So to run the matrix estimation with the maximum entropy method, just call the matrix estimation function, providing row sums and call sums. This tries to fill in the blanks as evenly as possible, considering the marginal constraints. And we have another method, which is the minimum density estimation method. You can call the same code as before, just change the method to MD. And this, it uses this assortative heuristic to fill in the blanks, considering that it's costly to maintain too many relations. So summing up, you can use our package to assess systemic risk by reconstructing the lateral networks from partial data, computing different topological metrics for systemic risk analysis, running contagion simulations with different methodologies, you can even implement your own. The package is on GitHub, it's still in development, and everybody's.
About GeoFIS, that is an R-based open source software for analyzing and zoning the spatial data. So first, why GeoFIS? I could move a little, so stop me if you are busy. So first, spatial information, especially where I work in agriculture and environment, it's growing information with all the sensors with GPS. And we are in need for tools to handle this information in order to represent the information, to display it, to treat it, and to analyze it. And there are existing tools, but because of property rights, there are some costs, there are limited functionalities, and some comes with some complexity. So it's for that that we decided to propose GeoFIS, that is a free and open source software, and it's that I will present you today. So first, the technical aspects. So GeoFIS is written in Java, and it makes R call for analysis function. So it's mainly based on the GStat package, and it uses R server in order to import R objects into Java. And we have also specific function in C++ for performance, for zoning purposes. So what can we do with GeoFIS? I don't have the time to say everything, but we can load and visualize spatial data. We can manage the attributes, the colors, the shapes of the attributes. We can study biographic analysis in order to prepare the spatial interpolation that we will see. We have a video about that. And we can create some zoning in order to simplify the spatial information. And then we can export the files for later use with GIS software, for example, or R. So here, an example of biographic analysis and 3G. So here we can fit a diagram. I don't know if we are aware about the spatial data, but we can fit the diagram with the farm parameters. And when you have fitted this diagram, it's possible to save it and to use it in order to make the caging and get the results that we obtain after caging. So some summary about all of that and perspective. So what we want to do with GeoFIS is to be on the first three steps of analysis of spatial data, so the pre-treatment, the biographic analysis, and the interpolation. So there are existing tools for that, but we want a tool that can manage all this aspect. And after that, we can export it and use it in cartographic elements like QGIS or ArcGIS, different software. And so this software is used by students. It's also used by some organizations and some companies. And as perspective, in fact, every research that we make, we add it in the software. So we are working at the moment on fuzzy zoning and an index in order to know the zoning opportunities, and a methodology to build some zones based on ISO compute. And another point that we want to make to open the software to the R community is to be able to call GeoFIS functions directly from R. So I finish with the presentation, and thank you for your
attention.
And you can go to the website if you want to know more or contact me by mail.
Okay.
So I thought this was going out auto advanced tonight, and I thought there was a high probability that my Linux, but after watching the lightning talks yesterday, that there was a small chance it was a random other presentation that I would just have to give. I was secretly hoping. It depends what the talk is on, I guess.
That's true.
So my name is Sandy Griffith. I work at a healthcare technology startup in New York City called Flatiron Health. And this talk today is about some of the lessons that we have learned using R at a rapidly scaling healthcare tech startup. And some of the things that today is joint work with Josh Kraut. You can find me on Twitter at Scriptor or by email here. And some of the things I'm going to talk about are things that I think are kind of somewhat unique to tech startups and also rapidly scaling ones, where teams are growing really quickly and people are often moving from team to team as we grow. So a little bit of background about me first. My story is that I came from the world of academic biostatistics, first as a grad student, then as a faculty member. At the time, pretty much everybody around me was using R. I was using R exclusively. Now, working at Flatiron in tech, there's a whole host of different options, Python, SQL, SAS. So what do we do at Flatiron for background? We work on serving cancer patients by trying to improve treatment and accelerate research, which sounds like a pretty ambitious goal. So how do we do that? We do that by processing EHR data at scale. And so this is a little bit of how that works just from the surface. We have structured data that we clean and harmonize, and then we have unstructured data where there's information living deep in notes and scanned documents, and then we combine these and process these at scales to create research quality data that can then be used for a whole host of things. So like I said, rapidly scaling. I joined about a year and a half ago. Since then, the company has over doubled. The quantitative sciences team alone went from 1 to 10. very small scale survey of my team about the language they were most comfortable with when they joined. And actually SaaS was the number one. A lot of people are coming from this kind of healthcare space where in some ways SaaS is actually more frequently used. And there were a combination of other things. So early on, we came to a decision point to say, should we use R? Oh, should we use something else? And my colleague Melissa made this list of pros and cons for SaaS and R. Some of the pros for R were practical things like Git and Max that it worked well with. Some were things like sweatshirts. She thought the sweatshirts, I think their prior R was way cooler. So that was it, we decided. So after we decided to use R, how do we cultivate a culture of R? And we've done this in a few ways, through an internal R package, through a user group, through a Slack channel, trainings, and really targeted hirings. If you want to know more, actually Airbnb wrote this great blog post that describes a lot of those things. So did it work? In fact, it did. This is the self-rated proficiency of the team at time of hire to now. And you can see that the number of self-rated intermediate and advanced teachers has gone way up. So this has been really successful and really rewarding and satisfying to watch. But now that we have our users, in what cases should we use R? Remember, like I said, there's a lot more software engineers who are primarily using Python. So do we use R in every case? When should we not? So I've seen over time three different kinds of scenarios emerging for different parts of the life cycle that we use R. And I'm going to talk about each one and why and in what cases it makes sense. So the first is to use R for prototypes and then something that's not R in production. And we found that this worked well for stable methods that we're not rapidly iterating on. Sometimes if it's repeated daily at scale, there's a little bit less friction. Also, transparency to a wider audience of non-R users is really useful when people are changing teams as we grow rapidly. So R as a long-term solution sometimes makes a lot of sense too, especially if the requirements are dynamic and we're rapidly iterating. But it's helpful if it's a mature product in a team where we know there's going to be R users that remain embedded on the team over time. Also, strong support and collaboration with software engineering helps a lot. The third case I've seen emerging is where we use R and not R in parallel together. And we often do this for problems where the stakes are high or the error tolerance is low. Because often it's complicated and we just really want to make sure that we get it right. The choice of language, often as R and Python, is somewhat incidental, but it's a nice bonus. More, we just want two people thinking about it. So in summary, what lessons have we learned so far? One, deciding that R was the way forward really helped. That way, and I mean the sweatshirt really helped with that decision. That way we were able to actually focus our resources on actively cultivating a culture of R. And then last, we're thinking more about when we should use R and when not to use R. So I just want to thank some of my colleagues and other R users of the company and throw out a shameless plug to join our team because we are trying to grow even more rapidly. Thank you.
Okay, so my name is Fred Bain. I am presenting some work on event detection with social media data that's co-authored by Robert Turner, who's an undergraduate student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and Brett Hanlon, a professor of statistics there, where I'm also a graduate student. A brief overview of what I want to talk about. So I'll give you some insight into what motivated our study. I'll discuss the strategy and methods that we used. I probably don't need to say a whole lot about Twitter to this audience, but I do have a slide for those who are not familiar with it. So the motivation. Topic models, such as latent Dirichlet allocation, enable analysts to identify themes or topics in a collection of texts. Some of the questions that we had include, how can we apply LDA to time series data? And then, can we identify events that correspond to changes in social media discourse? Our strategy was to choose a short-lived political or social event that generated a lot of discussion on Twitter. We then would fit topic models of tweets before, during, and after the event, and compare the topics that we see that we learned from those three time periods. We would be interested in, do any new topics appear during the event? So Twitter, as most of you probably know, users are allowed to post messages of 140 characters or fewer in length. And there's a streaming API that enables users to download an approximately 1% sample of all tweets during a chosen time period. If you have a larger budget, if you have a budget, you can download more tweets, but I'm working for free, so. A political scientist at NYU called Pablo Barrera wrote a very useful R package called StreamR. It allows a user from an R session to query the API of Twitter and get downloaded tweets. Latent Dirichlet allocation is the main machine learning method, unsupervised machine learning method that we're using. It allows the user to identify themes or topics is the technical term in a collection of text. This 2003 article discussing it has 15,000 citations. So a few bits about latent Dirichlet allocation. I don't have time to go into the mathematical details, but notice that it models a collection of documents. Each document is seen as a mixture of these topics. So this has so we're drawing on some ideas from mixture models here. So our Super Bowl 2015 study, we decided to collect tweets from the Twitter streaming API before, during, and after the February 1st, 2015 Super Bowl. We then fitted LDA models of tweets at three time periods, 12 hours before kickoff for an hour, and then during kickoff, and then 12 hours after. A few facts about the Super Bowl: it kicked off at 5:30 Central Time and featured the Patriots and Seahawks, and some of the key players and the halftime show featured several musicians. And I mention those because they'll come up in a moment when we see the results. So we fitted LDA models of three distinct collections of tweets. We fit topic models with 20 topics per collection. That 20 was an arbitrary selection, but seemed reasonable at the time. We noticed that 12 hours before the Super Bowl, there were no topics related to the Super Bowl. During the Super Bowl, we saw topics such as this, where we see a collection of tweets relating, a collection of words relating to the commercials. So notice that Budweiser and puppy show up. Some might recall the golden retriever pup commercial from that time. Another topic we saw dealt with some of the key players. So you see Tom and Brady showing up. Edelman is a wide receiver. You see some of the key plays, touchdown, interception. Richard Sherman shows up. Gronk, one of the tight ends for the New England Patriots. And so we still have a lot of work that we want to put into this project. We'd like to develop topic models that explicitly incorporate the time element for our streaming data. We also want to evaluate the methods that we're using posterior predictive checks and also some measure of topic coherence. And so I see I'm nearly out of time. My contact information is here. You can reach me by email. And our parse tweet files R package, which Robert Turner authored, is available on GitHub. So thank you very much.
Hello, everybody. My name is Ethan Brown. I'm from the University of Minnesota. So I want to ask, how many of you are planning to ever develop a multiple choice test or any kind of psychological rating scale? Show of hands. One person, three, five people. The rest of you can enjoy the cartoons. I'm from the University of Minnesota. I said this, I developed this package with a whole bunch of other people, so I don't deserve all the credit. This package helps you create a really simple report to help you focus on those details so you can do fancier other things with your test and not think about these little details quite so much. So let's say you're developing a test. You have some sort of stem about Suzy Science, and then you have a bunch of possible response options for your analysis. These are usually called distractors, the ones that are not the correct answer. We'll come back to that in a moment. Most tests are horrible because we put out answers that don't make sense or that are really measuring something different. So my package helps you diagnose those to sort of see where your test is kind of going off the rails, because chances are the first time even experienced assessment developers do bad things. So our assessment helps with several parts of the process here. We've got make it easy to score your test and to create a report with reliability and a bunch of other just kind of simple classical test theory psychometrics so you can get a good sense of what is going on with your test. You need to tell us about your test a little bit, just simple response data with examinees in rows, items in columns, and some simple information about the key to allow us to score the test. And we can do both binary items or some kind of partial credit, kind of more fancy things too. And then there's just a couple really simple commands that does the magic of the package. So you just enter that into a function called analyze. You can get some summary reports at the R console. But you can also spit out the command report, and then it generates this detailed report in HTML where document anything that R Markdown supports. So you want reliability estimates, we've got reliability estimates for you. We've got five different kinds here. There's lots of various methodologies for doing that. It's kind of like an R-squared progression of the variance that's true variance, the rest is error. You want this number to be high. It's good for your test if that number is high. To see what's making your reliability of your test lower, we have some item statistics. So this is the kind of correlation of that item with the rest of the test. If that's low, that means maybe that item is measuring something different, there's something different or weird going on in that item, and that is attacking the reliability of your test and bringing it down. So you can dive even deeper into your items and look at the individual response options and see how they're performing by the tercile of the student. So you want the correct answer to get more likely and the other answers to get less likely, and so you can kind of examine that pattern and see individual response options, how those are performing in a kind of detailed way. There's some cool things coming with the package. We're working on a shiny UI. We're working on ways of dynamically excluding items. We're hoping to get more advanced psychometrics in there, like IRT and G-theory eventually. And some analysis by groups, differential item functioning, and that kind of thing. My talk is actually a little bit shorter, so thank you very much, and I want you to meditate and find inner peace in the next 1 minute. Thank you very much.
Take your phones out. If you have a chance, you can see a dynamic version of some of the slides that I'm going to present here. So especially during the awkward moments when I can stop and pause, you can look at nice animated GIFs.
Can you read that? That URL?
Outlier 2016.
Okay.
So Ethan, that's the same slide, right?
No, it's repeated.
Okay.
It's repeated. Yep. It's exactly 15 slides.
It's not continuum.
We'll leave the entire presentation for you.
You can close your eyes if you want.
You want to stand up real quickly, stretch?
I swear this is 1 minute, and that's it.
Glad you guys have all stuck through this. Is share a shiny app I made that helps you kind of play around with different outlier algorithms. So again, if you want to kind of see the slides, you can go here. I have the GitHub where all the code is, and you'll kind of put that up one more time as we talk about this. So why do we care about outliers, right? Sometimes when we're thinking about outliers, it's because we have bad data, right? And we might just want to find them in that case. In other cases, right, the outliers might be the really interesting part of our analysis, and we want to use methods to find, kind of highlight the findings. And outlier analysis is a study unto itself, right? Agarwal's written this like 400 or 500 pound page tome on all the possible different methods about that, right? There's lots of different algorithms, so if you're jumping into this, it's easy to kind of get overwhelmed with all the different possible ways you can do outlier analysis. So what I did was I kind of took all the various R packages that I could find that had things to do with outliers, put them together in a nice shiny app where you could choose an algorithm, choose some data sets, and then it's actually interactive. You can actually click on those dots and remove dots and kind of make your own data set and test out and see kind of what's being highlighted. So the algorithms include hierarchical clustering, k-means, fuzzy k-means, isolation forest is in there. From dbScan, I have local outlier factor, as well as an autoencoder is thrown in there as well. So lots of different choices kind of to explore. Number of different data sets. Again, you can kind of click and modify and add your own data sets, but from random data to some classical ones that are used, kind of the butterfly, the smiley face, the donut, the spiral, all this kind of good stuff that allows you to get a better sense of which outliers methods, right, can get which kinds of data. So a simple example, and if you look at your phones and your computers now, you can see this, is with scaling, right? One of the things is scaling really affects something like k-means for what are the outliers that are going to be seen, what are the outliers that are going to be expressed. And so if you click on scaling on the button here, in this case, you would see different outliers. Similarly, you know, one of the things you can do is pull up a data set like the butterfly, try different algorithms, and sometimes you'll see as different algorithms give you different outliers. So in this example with the butterfly, if you switch between, I think it's isolation forest and the autoencoder, you'll see that they both identify different outliers. And so this starts to help you get an understanding of the data set. One more example with this is fuzzy k-means versus traditional k-means. You can again see how these different algorithms choose differently. An important thing too, and I'm going to point out, is at the bottom there is the distance there, where you can kind of see why those points are being chosen as an outlier. So distance versus density are two classical methods for doing outlier detection. This allows you to kind of take one example that's based around kind of loosely compacted ones versus tightly compacted and see what happens when you change those algorithms and really kind of help you get an intuitive sense of how these work. Right? Some algorithms are stochastic. So for example, with the autoencoder, if you run the autoencoder several times, you might end up with different results. But hey, that's what's going to happen when you run this in real life, so it's good to kind of get those intuitions now. All right, so one of the nice things I have at the bottom is kind of a data frame with the results, which have all the different points, as well as what the distance measure is for. And so that gives you an idea of whether these outliers are kind of very closely connected to the data, or whether they're really kind of very well separated from the data. So just another kind of intuition on how these are working. The code is out there. You can kind of grab it. Feel free to add other outlier methods, different data sets, lots you can do with it. I also have a demo running on my Shiny server. Don't all click on it right now because it'll die. Feel free after this to explore it. So the next step is can we go beyond this, right? Can we go beyond two-dimensional data? One of the issues here is how do you visualize it? So right now, for example, I have a T-SNE. It's computationally difficult, so this is something I can't run on my Shiny server anymore. You know, what data sets do you want to use? So right now I've been kind of choosing some data sets where we know what the outliers are. So we can kind of use that to help figure out what are the algorithms. All right, so that's it. Again, it's kind of outliers. It's a nice little app. It ties in very well to all the stuff we've talked about today with Keynote, about thinking about different ways of learning. Let me know if you have any questions. Feel free to reach out. Thank you.
I'm a data scientist at Translink, which is a transit tech.
what are all those letters? GTFS is the General Transit Feed Specification, and it's a standard, it's really just a collection of flat files, but there's a specification for what it includes about routes and stops and trips and all the information that you need to describe a transit system, and it's what Google accepts to put into Google Maps app for transit. So why write an R package for this? Like I said, it's just a bunch of flat files, it's not a special format. So I'm gonna tell you the four reasons that this seemed like a useful thing to do. And it's really meant to be a basic kind of utility package to encourage more people to build on top of this type of data. So the first thing is to find data. So if you already have data for a GTFS feed, that's great, you can use that. If you don't, there's a wrapper to the Transit Feeds API that lets you go explore the data that's there. And also, if you want a whole bunch of transit data from a whole bunch of different places, that's a nice way to do that. The second thing is to validate the data that you get. So part of this package looks at the data that you pull down and gives a report of what problems there might be and creates a table of the different levels of data quality that are represented in comparison to the spec. And so validation is actually where we put some of the most thought into this package. And most of, the most common tool for transit agencies to create GTFS feeds is Microsoft Excel, which you can imagine leads to some issues with data quality at times. So validation so that you know the data you're working with will actually make sense and be usable is really important. The third thing is to provide a standard structure for this data. So there's a GTFS class that's created when you read a feed in with a package. And we hope that will kind of be a standard so that other people can build on top of this and assume some things about the data coming in if it has that class. The next thing is to make some basic maps. So you get this data in, you want to see what the system looks like. So you can map by stop or by routes with stops or map the whole system. And we'll do that. There. So this is a leaflet map that would be interactive in a non-PDF form showing the Duke University transit system, and there are a bunch of different options for making these maps. So even if you don't actually work with transit data, if you just want to pull the feed from your local transit system, it would be easy to make a map and look at where it is. So the package right now is on R OpenSci Labs, but it's under review to move to the main R OpenSci repo, so you should be able to find it there hopefully soon. And there's a nice vignette. I didn't show you anything about how to actually use the package because the vignette does a great job of that. So that's the best place to start if you want to check it out. So the main reason for giving this talk is to invite people to collaborate on developing things with this data. And there's three things that you could do in a collaborative fashion. So the first one, obviously, is to go check out the package, look at the vignette, try it out. Pull some data, and then send us feedback about either problems that you find or, more importantly, like the way that you would like to use this data and anything that could be added that would be helpful in making the package useful. So that's step one. The next thing would be if you write R code and you find something that you want to add, so you write it and send us a pull request, and then collaborate with us on further developing the package. And then the real motivation for developing this package, as I said, is to have a standard on top of which people can build other R packages that actually analyze the data or combine this data with census data or anything else that might be useful. So the best thing would be, if you are writing such a package, to consider using the GTFS class as depending on the package, as a way to get that data in. And that will also help you be able to handle, like, knowing that the data meets the spec at a basic level and being able to check about some optional things that might be provided that would also be useful. So last plug for Translook, we're hiring across the board engineers, data engineers, data scientists, and other less technical things, particularly if you are or know a great data engineer who is R-friendly, please let me know.
So we are mainly dealing with geological data, and that's the original motivation for the package I'm talking about. It's called GM Database. GM stands for Geometallurgical Database. And there we want to fill in data, handle with data that comes from exploration, from processing minerals, and so on. And this kind of data always have some natural hierarchical structure. They have research, there are references between the hierarchy levels, and there's a graphic structure. And the thing is, we want to preserve this structure because the structure itself gives some additional information we want to store in the database somehow. So we need to keep the structure. The next thing is the data we are dealing with is very diverse. So we have databases, spectral data, data frames. We want to store the images or diagrams. And of course, the data volume is much larger than the main memory. So we have to store it somewhere in order to use it afterwards or become part of it afterwards. We want to use this data inside R. So we have to get out of the database into R. That's one problem. And then we do not want the user to know the structure of the database itself. So we just need to use some very short functions to access the data, and then there has to be some data management. So we use the relational database, and there we have some tables where we just store the data itself. So one table for strings, one table for the integer, and so on. And then we have some tables, some small number of tables where we get all the management part, because we have to know where we are spreading the data of the object we want to store. The system itself should be very flexible. So in the end, every kind of object we are imagining should be able to store it in database. So in the end, we're using a class-like concept. And class means in this situation that the class is just a set of or a set of objects with the same kind of properties. So in the end, an instance will be in the data frame just a row, and the columns represent the properties itself. And the good thing is here that in the column there can be the things in the column can class it itself. So here comes the hierarchy in play, into play. So we can go deeper into the object. So we can have their class there inside. So we get one step below in the deeper in the hierarchy in the end. So furthermore, we put the rights management system into the system itself. So we have the objects, we have their class for rights groups, for user groups and users. So everything of this is stored in the database too. And we can handle it in the same way as we are handling the rest of the data. So in the end, as I told you, no SQL knowledge is needed to use the system. That's good. And yeah, we of course provide a template, or we provide the database itself, which is ready to use for the user. And the user only has to think of new classes he wants to, classes he wants to store in the database. So in the end, instead of using complicated SQL commands, we are trying these kind of things. So we start always with a root vertex because it's a hierarchy, so we have to start somewhere. And then if we want to go one step deeper in the hierarchy, we're just using the dollar command to go one step further. The database is accessible through R directly or via server, and if the files you want, or if there are files you want to store, they are very large, so you don't store it in that database directly, you just store the link to the place where it's stored on the server. So the last things I want to mention are two examples where we are using this. One example, of course, is this geometallurgical database. So we have there data we want to store from several analytical instruments. It's organized in project samples, series, and so on. And for example, we are storing images of an electron scanning microscope, which we want to have a look at and to analyze afterwards. And we are planning, or we are currently working the whole geometallurgical suite. So our packages, we should be able to analyze the data, to simulate things out of the data, and so on, and so to get the whole value chain. Last thing we are using this database and the package for is our project management data, or database system in the end. It's called HIFMO because our institute is called HIF, and then MO we are using geological data. Yeah. So thank you.
give a plug to a package that I wrote in Google. And one thing is, it's a formatter. It turned out extremely useful. There was a large amount of demand for it. They asked that I make it open source. I'm here to do the plug. I have all the formatting code. Obviously, for most purposes, most of the time, if you're doing one off script, you don't want to. If you're doing collaborative programming, or particularly if you're using programs later on, it's good to help. It's helpful to format. One of the problems that you often encounter when you've got a very structured environment like Google, people insist on language columns. This can be a major pain. Whether you agree or not, they are actually quite widely established. Google, as I say, particularly, but in Linux, Emacs, etc. And if you've ever come across this, R does not like being line broken. And every time you change a code, fix a bug, you find you're having to realign everything. If it comes down to it, you often find yourself changing your variable names because of the line break tool. And nobody can agree on exactly how formatting should work. The solution, which is increasingly popular, is to have the machine read, which relieves you of an enormous burden. You do your code however you wish. You throw it over the fence, the machine does it. It conforms to the format. In the case of Google, nobody could figure out what the format was, and it was nice to have this thing sorted out. There is an existing solution, Format R, available on CRAN. Beautiful piece of work. It relies on a very clever subversion of the R parser and the D parser. It has problems forcing comments through this particular relation. If you use it with apparently natural comments, such as inline comments within a function call like that, it breaks. And that's, as I say, because it's doing extremely clever things to get that stuff through the parser and back out again. And it's fresh. It's quite interesting, I think. As I say, it's very, very clever. Nicely done. It relies on various operating. Oh, there we go. And also, it doesn't really break lines in a very nice fashion. The RD parser was never designed to do this. It's a bit ad hoc. Here I've put an 80 column limit. You see the wraps on the left there where it's gone over the line. And also the formatting, it's not bad. It's certainly better than nothing, but it's not probably the most readable. This system designed from the ground up because I have nothing better to do. It has its own parser, it parses things. It has a clever constraint optimization routine in there to do the layout. It's very pluggable, it's full of nice object-oriented affordances. It actually manages your comments quite nicely, and that goes through no problem. Largely, as I say, because it's doing everything itself and it's written with this purpose in mind, it's not trying to make use of the parser in a way for which it wasn't designed. Also, as you can see, the layout's rather tidier. It makes more sense. It tends to chunk things in more readable sort of packages. It's probably pluggable, so if you don't agree with this particular type of format, you can change it. It takes more or less amount of effort. Installing it very easy. You take nothing else away from this. Take away the Google GitHub repository. And I don't know, it's very, very easy to install from GitHub. This is set up for you, so just get your dev tools package, which is available everywhere. Do an install GitHub from that, and you'll have it. It'll be there. Using it, very, very straightforward. Load the library, you can format a file from it, you can format text, it'll actually format the clipboard if you like it. There's lots and lots of options, probably more options than you need. You can format directories and so on and so forth. As I say, lots and lots of options. You can set the margins, you can set how it tries to break lines, but there are vast numbers of them available from the help. It also plugs into the shell. You can run these little commands, which, all things being equal, will put it into your bash init. all your bare minutes, all your Emacs in it. If you want the true nerd of them, I think with all the story details at the top of that, which I think is actually in the package. So go ahead, download it. If any of you fine programmers want to come and help fix my code, that would be, of course, extremely great. It does work, but I'm sure there's still to be done.